Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're just learning about this show, please know it is on the air for you by bringing on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain. Our goal for each show is to bring answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at Answers.network and browse through a variety of heartfelt and enlightening topics. I am confident that there is something you will find to bring greater joy to your life. Now, I also have a favor to ask. Please forward at least one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is just one powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world together. Now, speaking of making a positive influence, that can certainly be said about today's guest and the famous playwright that she writes about. Now, our topic today is also the title of our guest's new book, Of Human Kindness, What Shakespeare Teaches Us About Empathy, a book that takes readers through a selection of Shakespeare's most famous plays to demonstrate the ways in which Shakespeare thought deeply and clearly about how we treat others. Our guest, Paula Morantz Cohen, is the Dean of the Pannoni Honors College and a distinguished professor of English at Drexel University, as well as host of the television interview show, The Civil Discourse. Paula, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I have had the pleasure of reading your book, and it touches on so many things that when I initially read Shakespeare, I didn't get some of the same things that you're getting. So it was so enlightening to me to now start thinking about some of those same things that I read many years ago. And you're right, you know, it makes me think a lot more. So anyway, I've had a wonderful time reading the book. But why don't you share with us what led you to write a book on kindness through the eyes and interpretation of Shakespeare's plays?
Well, it's a big question, but I will say that I am not a conventional Shakespearean. I came, even though I'm an English professor, my field was elsewhere in 19th century British literature. I only began to teach Shakespeare relatively late, about 20 years ago. That's still a long time, mm-hmm. when the Shakespeare expert retired at my university and I took it on, I thought, temporarily. But I became really enamored of the plays. What I was particular, and I'd seen many of the plays in performance, professional performances, high school performances, all manner. Mm-hmm. But the fact of reading the plays closely with intelligent students, with college students, really showed me what an extraordinary mind Shakespeare had, and how much he learned in writing his plays about human nature. And how much more forgiving, compassionate, and empathetic he became the more he wrote.
Well, as many people out there may not be as familiar with his work, can you describe for our audience some of the most famous and familiar plays of Shakespeare?
One of the most performed, I think, is Richard III. There are many movie versions, and it's a play that's put on quite often. It's an early history play, English history play. And I see it as a kind of beginning point for Shakespeare because the main character, Richard III, is an unequivocal villain. You do not feel empathy for him. So in a way, you read this play and you would say, well, that doesn't support her thesis. And that's the point, is that I do think that Shakespeare began as a dramatist who wanted, you know, a lot of bang for his buck. And mm-hmm. so he created a villain who would kill a lot of people. And would, you know, be, you know, chew up the scenery, so to speak. And, you know, Al Pacino played Richard III on mm-hmm. Broadway, I believe. And also he made a movie looking for Richard where he talks about what it feels like to play this character. But he's appropriate for the role because you know how he likes to be histrionic.
Yes.
But he's a beginning point. There's something very significant about the character. And if you don't mind, I'll read the first lines of the play that show this.
I would love that.
Okay, I'm going to skip a few lines after the first very famous line. This is the first line of the play. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. He is referring to the end of a war that will now allow everybody to celebrate, to, you know, to be happy, to make love, to have festivity. And he says this for a few more lines, and then he shifts. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks. And I should tell you that history tells us that Richard III had a deformity. He was a hunchback, or it's still not clear exactly what kind of deformity, but physically a deformity. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I, that am rudely stamped and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I, that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that's so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time unless to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. I think it's just an extraordinary speech.
Yes, it is.
But that's that. There's no more psychological insight than that in the entire play. In other words, he's decided he's not good looking. He's going to go out and wreak havoc on everything that he touches. And that's it.
He's going to punish everybody else for having what he doesn't have.
Exactly. And the grievance, you know, the anger, the bitterness of that speech is incredible. But Shakespeare never picks up on it in the play. And he just makes him a flat villain. And that will change, in my view, in subsequent plays where Shakespeare's just not content to have a flat villain any longer. It's not really interesting. It's certainly not morally interesting.
Well, what they would say today is he has no arc. He starts out as one thing and he remains that. And what we've learned over, you know, over time in regards to movie making, to put things out to the masses is that they want to see an arc of some sign, of some type, so that they can feel that there's been some level of growth. And I think what you're saying is that in later plays, he started to see that. And so that's why we see characters that have more growth, that have more compassion and more emotion that they're showing.
You know, Alan, in some part, that's true. And that's true of the later Henriade plays, the later English history plays, which actually take place earlier than Richard III, because he went backwards and wrote a prequels after he wrote the first four history plays. But in other ways, it's different. It's not so much that they have an arc where they get more complicated or they grow. It's that Shakespeare becomes more attuned to what makes a villain and why it is that someone we might want to feel for someone we despise or whose ideas or actions we despise. And that to me is the real challenge for empathy. It's easy to be empathetic to people you like or people that you identify with or people that have your ideas. It's much harder to be empathetic toward people that seem to have loathsome ideas and have done loathsome things. That's a challenge.
Now, do you think he was able to do that by creating more of a backstory so that by presenting what that person went through, that that people now are having more empathy for them, even though they didn't become what they could have been?
I think that by creating an antagonist for the hero, or having two characters as opposed to one central character, as in Richard III, even though he concentrated on the heroic character, he also became more interested in thinking about the antagonist to that character, or to this structural, you know, this constellation of people around us, and how each one can have different ideas, even though we may be at the center. And he may be more interested in, say, Henry V. I'm thinking about the Henry V play. He's also interested in the other characters who make Henry V who he is by interacting with him. And I see this as a gradual thing, because I think what happens is he'll write a play and then there'll be a loose end of some sort, you know, a character that's sort of a stray character. And it jolts him, or it spurs him right. to want to pursue that further. And I feel The Merchant of Venice is the most important play in that respect. I don't know if your viewers know that play.
No, actually, I'm not familiar with it. Viewers may very well be, though.
It's a very odd play. It's considered a comedy. And it has the Jew Shylock. So even though you haven't heard of The Merchant of Venice, you've probably heard of the character of Shylock.
Yes.
Who's a moneylender and who demands his pound of flesh of the character who reneges on his loan. And the character of Shylock is a villain in the play. And he's treated as a villain. And in the end, he's severely punished. But Shakespeare gives him a speech in Act Three that makes you think about this character in a different way. Again, I have it here. I can read it if you want.
Well, no, I would love that, and that's why I say one of the things that I think is so compelling about your book and the way in which you've put it together is, I love things that make us think, and yeah. and you talk about how we may now look at another person differently once we know this piece of information. So yes, please do.
Yeah, I think it does make us think about groups or individuals that we have written off.
Mm-hmm.
So Shylock, as I said, is a Jew and is treated with contempt by all the other characters in the play. And he's positioned as the villain. And traditionally, this has been how he's been read and been portrayed in theater as a very, you know, an unsavory, grasping villain. But he has this speech. I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? And if you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, do we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. And that speech, which is quite famous, is an explanation of how villains do tend to get formed out of resentment, out of being treated as subhuman, and as by imitating what others do to him back again. And it does, I think, and over time, this character has become far more sympathetic in the way he's portrayed on stage and on screen, because I think as, you know, as we become more aware of other people who don't like us, we hear this more clearly than they did perhaps in the 19th century when it was performed. It's hard to say how Shakespeare's audience felt. There were very few, if any, Jews in England at the time he wrote. So he's thinking theoretically about this outcast character. And he could not help but give the character this speech, which is so poignant, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the thoughts that comes to mind is that someone, we're talking about someone that loans money.
I mean, yes.
And someone that loans money can be a bank, and or it can be a loan shark. It can be, you know, where someone borrows the money to build their business, which then makes them very successful. But it can also be the person who is loaned the money and then loses their job, so they lose their house. You know, yeah. So it's a much broader picture of what somebody can be in that profession. But in many cases, it gets demonized as only one side of it.
Exactly. And because of the way it's possible to portray this character and to make him look, and also because he's so insistent on getting, they make a deal, he and the other character in the play, that if this character reneges on the loan, Shylock will get a pound of this man's flesh. Mm. And it seems like a joke.
Right.
But when he can't pay it back, the ships get lost at sea or they're delayed, Shylock insists that he should have that pound of flesh. And nothing seems to get in his way. He will not, you know, agree to back down on this. And when someone says to him, well, what good will it do you? He says, it will stoke my revenge. You know, it's because of this bitterness that I have mm-hmm. that I want it. And ultimately, he's able to be essentially tricked out of this. And when Portia, who's the female character, dresses up as a man, as a lawyer, and gets the merchant off of this arrangement, Shylock, she does not give him mercy, even though she's asked mercy from him. So it's an interesting perspective on a society that, on the one hand, seems to be, you know, it puts certain characters in a positive light, and yet it shows how hypocritical that society can be. And there are actually three outsider characters in the play that make it so interesting. One is the woman who, in order mm-hmm. to exert her brilliance, must dress like a man, which happens in a number of Shakespeare plays. And the other is a gay man who it's not explicit, but it's pretty clear. And he also is an outsider character. And he's the merchant of the title. He's the one from whom Shylock wants to take his pound of flesh. So it's an interesting look at three minority figures, marginal figures, and how they sort of play off of each other within the context of the play, which takes place in Venice. Shakespeare sets it in Venice. And I wonder, and of course we can't know what Shakespeare is saying about these people and how they need to use the other to in order to exist themselves. It's very, very fascinating.
Well, and maybe it is just exactly what we're doing right now. Mm. He wants to make people think, and he wants you to talk about these issues, talk about race, talk about class, talk about gender.
Yes.
At a time in which, you know, he might have been stoned if he came out and did it directly.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was very, very diplomatic. I mean, he was very politically savvy. So, you know, for example, there is a usurpation scene in Richard II when his troupe performed that play in front of Elizabeth, who was queen then. Mm-hmm. He took that scene out because he felt it might be threatening to her as mm-hmm. a monarch. So he was very aware, but he never comes out and, you know, says something directly. And there are a lot of contradictory messages. But then again, life is complicated, isn't it?
Right.
And there is no easy, it would be propaganda if it were simplistic.
Yep. Could not agree more. And I know you bring it up in the book, but describe for all of us how some of the greatest tragedies, you know, in the entire literary world has brought about deep compassion. Share a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I make a point of saying that, you know, for classical tragedy, the idea is catharsis. You know, you watch a Greek tragedy, and presumably at the end, you've had an emotional experience and you've rid yourself of any, you know, interfering emotion, and you can be refreshed and go out into the world. But I think that what makes Shakespeare unique, and he's not to say that there aren't other writers that do this, especially after Shakespeare, is that it's less about catharsis, I think, than it is about empathy or compassion. And so we don't have this, we don't rid ourselves of our feelings. We keep, and I like your point that we keep the, we have thoughts about our feelings. We think about why we feel this way about this character, or that character. And that, I think, brings us closer to each other, or closer to being able to fathom what, where someone else might be coming from.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, in going back to some of the characters, what are some of your favorite characters, and what are the messages that you felt they were portraying?
Well, I do spend a lot of time talking about Othello. You know, Othello is a famous, famous play about a black man, a Moor, as he's called. Mm-hmm. So sometimes he's considered Arab or black, or he's certainly dark-skinned. His skin is referred to many times throughout the play. And he is driven to feel his wife has been unfaithful to him by his first lieutenant, Iago, who is resentful because he was passed over for promotion. I should tell you that Othello was a great general and has a lot of prestige and respect, but he's still a black man in a white society. And that's very present in the play. And the reason why Iago is able to get to Othello and make him suspect his wife when his wife is innocent is because he has such low self-esteem, as my students would say. He feels himself to be out of place. He feels himself to not be worthy somehow of her. And as a result, he is vulnerable to Iago's argument. But one of the things I say in reading the play is that the character of Iago has been overlooked too, because this is a character who has served Othello as his first lieutenant. And when there's a promotion to be had, Othello gives the promotion to a very refined gentleman, Cassio, and not to Iago. And most readers and watchers slough this over as though it's really not a good motive for Iago being so vicious toward mm-hmm. Othello. But when you stop and think about it, Othello is as blind to Iago's claims as the society is blind to Othello's feeling of helplessness or feeling of inferiority. And so you see how these things duplicate themselves, and that Iago is unseen, not only within the play, but also by viewers and readers up till now as being, you know, they think of him as just a pure flat villain. But right at the beginning, we hear how, what it is that's driving him. He feels he deserved the seniority. He should have gotten that promotion, but it was given to somebody who had never been in the field, but who had the right credentials. And I think that a lot of people in our society now can relate to that.
Absolutely. Now, in that situation, do you think that Othello was making that decision to try to gain favor that would somehow help his own self-esteem by being able to now be closer to somebody that he felt was higher up on the ladder of society or whatever? Alan?
I actually think that is a brilliant theory, because although I never talk about that, but I think you are absolutely right. And I'm going to bring it up in class next time I teach it, that yes. And isn't it very common for people to want to ally themselves when they feel inferior? They want to ally themselves with someone with the pedigree or the elements that they feel they lack. I don't think Othello did it consciously. But I think it was, I think it's a human drive. And unless we're very vigilant, we do that. And I love that way of thinking about it, because it complicates it again and makes Othello even more responsible, even though I think he was not aware of what he was doing.
Well, I am enjoying this very much. And we're going to take a break. But for everybody out there, Stay with us. We're going to be back. Now, we are talking about kindness, but we're talking about it through the eyes of Shakespeare. So for everybody, stay with us. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. We're talking with Paula Cohen, and we're talking about her new book, Of Human Kindness, What Shakespeare Teaches Us About Empathy. So, Paula, one of my thoughts was it has to do with Hamlet, one of the most well-known pieces of that era. What are some of the things that that you feel that that Shakespeare touches on that really shows that he was ahead of his time in the way in which he could deeply and clearly talk about how we should treat each other?
Well, you know, Hamlet is a special case, and I really struggle with that play still because I think it's so complex and so confusing in certain ways. But I do think it's sort of an adolescent play, and to understand it, we have to understand how we feel about our parents and about becoming an adult and be more aware. I think one of the things that Hamlet is struggling with and that makes him so empathetic is that he doesn't want to give up an image of both his father and his mother that he had in childhood. And with that, he doesn't really want to give up a certain kind of dependency that one has on one's parents in childhood. And I go through a rather elaborate reading of the play to show this, but I think it's really an interesting counterpoint to King Lear, who is also a character that we feel for and should teach us to feel for people as they grow older. And since I am growing older, I feel for myself. Lear has sort of the opposite problem from Hamlet in that he has to accept getting old. It's hard for us to do that. And I think it's hard for younger people to see older people as complete human beings. Sort of the way people didn't see Othello within that society as a complete human being. Lear is in the same position. But he also, and then it also teaches us older people how difficult it is to raise our children fairly. Because ultimately what Lear does and that we can take lessons from is that he apportions out his love to his daughters. He creates a competitive environment for his love. And I think if we look to each other or we love each other in a competitive way, that will never end well for anyone. Right. And that's what happens. And even Cordelia in that play, who's considered the heroine, who has, you know, does nothing wrong, I feel that she is actually competing with her sisters for being the good daughter. And in the process, she's able to sort of win, even though she dies, because she gets to her father. So in a way, it's a cautionary tale of how we need to approach old age and how we need to deal with our children Both are very difficult. I mean, but I think, again, Shakespeare was understanding of that. And when you read this play closely, I think it helps you do it better. Hamlet, I know I started by talking about Hamlet. Hamlet is a separate story. It can be understood, it seems to me, in so many ways. But Lear is more about thinking about our society, and our society is aging too. So that, right. As a result, I think we really need to be very compassionate toward older people, but they too need to learn how to step aside and not think of themselves as so central anymore. That's a very hard thing to do.
Well, yeah, as you were saying that, that's exactly what I was thinking is that, you know, it's one of those things you have to look at both sides of it.
Yeah.
There is a passing of the torch.
Yeah.
And I think that there are times in which those of us that happen to be holding the torch need to not let our ego get involved and realize that, you know, it is the time of the next generation to take that torch and to move forward with it. And so, but it's interesting because what you're saying is that, I mean, Shakespeare has not only dealt with a lot of issues such as race, class, gender, but also the age issues that at some point in time, we're all going to deal with.
If we're lucky. Right?
If we're lucky. Exactly.
But it's funny, nobody thinks in those terms that this is something we all will experience, hopefully, at a certain point. And that would make us a little kinder, I think, to older people and more aware of their needs, because this is going to be a huge issue in the society of the future.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you would bring up King Lear and the age issue. I just got back from a week at an international conference, and so I was meeting people that I hadn't seen for 3 years because of COVID. And we were focusing a lot on some of our members who are now third generation within their line of work. And I've known their grandfather, their father, and now them. And I can see by looking at the different ones, how graceful some have passed the torch to the next generation, and how others struggled a little bit with it. So it is interesting that you would bring that one up, because I just had these observations within the last week.
That's interesting. Do you feel that it's because the gracefulness has to do with the way that this person raised their children?
I think it's a combination of both. One is the way in which they raised them. In fact, I had a conversation with one. We were talking about parenting, and I was saying that one of the most difficult things to do in parenting is to teach your child to question authority while you are still in authority.
That is so true. Right, because you also want them to respect you.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's a fine line.
Yeah. So anyway, but yes, again, but I, again, as I said, I love in the book how you touch a lot of these things, and it makes people think. I mean, it literally, reading the book, I now want to go back and either read or watch, and probably for time reasons, I'll watch some of the movies that have been made, you know, or go to the play, you know, more so than go back and read the books. But anyway, it has really made me, and I hope it will make many other people that are out there that are watching, that are listening, to go back and read, watch, you know, whatever you're more comfortable with, some of these things, but look at it through a different filter now, because that's what I'm looking forward to, is just reading your book now makes me see things a little differently. And I love that.
Thank you. And I try to make it very accessible and very short. I like short books.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
So, I'm just checking on the time. So let's talk a little bit about what else that you're working on, because I don't want to run out of time, because I know that you have another book coming out, and I'd love to know more about that, because what I think it does is it takes a lot of the things that we're talking about now, but brings it up to date to what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, thank you for asking. It's a book that will be out in February from Princeton University Press. It's called Talking Cure, an Essay on the Civilizing Power of Conversation. And I do believe very strongly in conversation. What we're doing right here is so important. You learn about each other when you sit down. I mean, ideally over a meal, and converse in person, but Zoom is better than nothing. Talking to people and not coming at them with a preconceived argument in mind, but rather sitting down with them in order to explore who they are. And that is what our country so desperately needs now, in my opinion.
I could not agree more. And it's interesting. I work with some people just in helping them heal after they've gone through something. And one of the things that I've done is that I've put together a list of the things that they need to do for their mental and physical health. And one of the things that's on there is to turn off any form of news and don't watch it.
Yeah.
Just stay away from it. You need to focus on your own health. And they aren't trying to tell us to look at something and to sit down and talk about it and to figure out what's best. They're trying to ram things down our throats, saying, this is what it is, this is what's right, and anybody that says something different is wrong and you should turn them off. And it's, to me, it's akin to, you know, to when you're a four-year-old and somebody starts saying something you don't want, and you stick your fingers in your ears and you go, nah, 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 nah. Okay. I mean, we're literally telling people to act like a four-year-old, only I don't want to insult four-year-olds.
You know? Yes, I agree. I agree. And we've stopped listening. Part of the problem is because we're talking about set subjects where we think we are right and the other person is wrong, but we're not allowing for discussion of all the other things in between that make us who we are. We are not our opinions on political issues. That is just a very small part and sometimes not a relevant part of who we are.
Yeah. And again, I mentioned where I was just at, and that group, there was over 100 of us together, and it's the World Association of Detectives.
Really? How fun.
Yeah. So we have over 100 of some of the top detectives. There's over 900 in the association, but there was over 100 of us for one meeting. And so we have people from Pakistan and we have people from India. You know, we have people from the Middle East. We have people from America. We have members from, you know, now looking at what we're dealing with today, from Russia and from Ukraine. And we're coming up on, we'll be coming up on our 100-year existence. So we've dealt with many conflicts as it would relate to from a political standpoint, but yet we are all a family and we don't feel the same things they're trying to tell us to feel.
Well, maybe because you have another issue that is central to you, which is what your shared vocation. And so that the other things are sort of secondary, and that becomes a way to bring you together. I think that's true of, you know, for example, as a teacher, I'm a dean of an honors college and all our courses are around a seminar table. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk, we're talking about books and ideas, and political things do crop up, but they're really secondary to talking about this other thing that is the subject of the course.
That's and a I good think point.
That makes us much more able to listen to each other. And I think that would be true of your conference.
Absolutely, yes. And we're listening, but for many of us that have been members for many, many years, you know, like I said, we see each other as family in the sense that, and family can have conversations and disagree. And there's a lot of people in there. As I said, in fact, one of my favorite conversations, I was seated, this is some years ago, there were 10 of us at the table. And through conversation, we realized that at one part of the table, we had a retired Pakistani general. And on another side of the table, we had a retired Indian colonel. And as everybody kept talking, they realized they were involved at one time in the same battle.
Oh. On opposite sides.
On the opposite side.
Yes.
And these two gentlemen at later on nominated each other for third vice president of the association to join the officers so that they could talk about things together, you know, and became friends and realized that, you know, what the politicians were saying and everything else was not true. There was no reason for anybody to dislike or hate each other. And so what I'm saying is, even when it got beyond our work, it was the fact that we're sitting down, we're breaking bread, and we are realizing that there are things that we really like about each other.
Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah.
Thank you.
I do think that we could have world peace if we could only get people to sit down with a really good meal.
Yeah.
I have in my book that's coming out a description of a meal that Virginia Woolf describes in her book, A Room of One's Own. And in it, she describes taking a lunch at what she calls Oxbridge. It's like a composite of Oxford and Cambridge, which are the two very elite universities in England. Mm-hmm. And she describes this elaborate meal, I mean, with wine and the most extraordinary dishes and desserts and so forth, and says that in this setting, people could talk freely. I'm trying to think of the line she uses. There was a free play of mind, nothing brilliant, just mm-hmm. collegial. And that night, because this was written, I think, very early in the 20th century, she goes to the women's college, newly formed, and it is very poor, unlike the men's colleges. And there she has this very bad dinner. And she says the talk was also very constrained because they didn't have that sense of ease. When you have a real sense of ease with another person, and food helps, wine helps, it helps you connect and feel all's right with the world, and you can be generous in the way you think about another person. When you have less, it's harder. And so if we could only make it possible for people to sit down over a really wonderful meal and talk, I think we could solve all the problems in the world today.
I'm right there with you. We have some listener questions and comments that have come in, so I want to get these in. We've got about 7.5 minutes yet. So the first one appears to be a comment. And again, thank you for everybody that takes the time to send these in. This one reads, I so enjoyed my theater classes in college, especially Shakespeare's plays. My friends and I would have long discussions about relationships of various characters and the emotions that would come up for each of us. My daughter is considering joining a local group, and I think your book would be helpful in explaining my passions for these great works. Thank you for writing your book. And this is from Vera in New Jersey.
That's great. Thank you, Vera.
All right. And we have one that said, I read a book entitled Shakespeare Identified that proposes that Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, was perhaps the real identity of William Shakespeare and responsible for creating these great works. What are your thoughts on this? And is there any evidence that this may be true? And this is from Mary in Michigan.
Well, this is a very ongoing debate as to who wrote Shakespeare's plays, because Edward de Vere is one very major candidate, and there are others. But I personally don't support this thinking, and I'll tell you why. One of the reasons why people feel that Shakespeare couldn't have written the plays is that he didn't have as much education as the aristocratic people like Edward de Vere or Christopher Marlowe, for example, who was very well educated in Latin and Greek and so forth. But I think it was precisely because Shakespeare mixed more with the people. His mother's family was sort of gentry. They owned some land. His father was a merchant. So it was a mixed marriage of sorts, at least for the time. Mm-hmm. And he was more attuned to the way different people think. And that's what makes his plays endure and speak to so many people in a way that others don't. But there's never, I think, going to be any proof one way or the other. And there's a lot of fun involved in thinking that maybe somebody else does. And there are books written, as the writer noted, that go to great lengths to show evidence in the plays and so forth, coded things that suggest that someone else, Edward de Vere or others, may have written them. But I don't buy it.
Well, it sounds like another interesting mystery to look into.
It is a mystery. There's a lot of mystery associated with Shakespeare, if you want to think that way.
All right. Well, we've got about 3 minutes. What are some of the things that that you would like to present? What are some of the things that here's the magic wand that you could do that you think would start us in that route of making a positive difference and making some changes in getting everybody communicating better?
That's a great question. I think there was a news article or an op-ed article that I read not long ago that I agree with, which is that one should try and speak to people in the course of a day, people that you might normally not speak to or not mm-hmm. even see. You know, somebody who might be giving you coffee, or somebody who is the janitor of your building, or somebody who works in another department, and just try and make a connection with that person. Because I think, first of all, we get a real high, I think, from connecting with somebody for the first time and realizing that we're all human and we share certain basic feelings. And it's wonderful to see that you can connect just by saying a few words or smiling even when you walk down the street. It depends on what city you're in, I guess. But in Philly, you have to be careful. But I still do believe that people are hungry for connection. Mm-hmm. And we can help make that happen. So I maybe that sounds a little mundane, but I do think it's a first step.
All right. So for everybody out there, say hello to somebody today, somebody you haven't met before. And so, Paula, what are the best ways for people to get your book?
I think on Amazon, or okay. I believe on Amazon is probably the best way. It's in some bookstores. I don't know how many people still shop at bookstores, mm-hmm. but it can, or from Yale University Press is okay. another way. Because that's a publisher.
All right. And if they would like to follow you and be ready on your list for when the new book comes out, what's the best way for them to follow you?
I don't have a social media presence. I have a website that I've let lapse, but I can be found at drexel.edu at the Pannoni Honors College. We have, if you want to contact me through email, I'm okay. the dean at Drexel University's Honors College, Pannoni Honors College. And if somebody writes me, I'd be glad to write back.
Sounds great. Paula, thank you so much. And I would love to talk again more, especially about your new book. And if it's coming out in February, if you let Jan know about 10 weeks or so ahead of time, would love to have you back. And let's talk about that one, because I think that taking all of the information you're talking about now, talking about what we can do now, is the perfect next step, or in this case, next book.
Thank you, Alan. It's really been a pleasure talking to you. You're a wonderful interviewer.
Thank you very much. And we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Now, for everybody out there, please be sure and join us next week when we're going to have the author of How to Grow Your Business Like a Weed. And right now, especially as we're coming out of COVID, anything that we can do to be able to grow our business and work smarter, I think could help all of us. So join us and also visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network. And you can subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many more. If you can do that, it will help us spread the word. And the more we can get this word out to people, the more we can make a positive difference together. Now, if you like what you hear, you can also leave a review. It'll help us to be able to continue to reach more people via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or any of those. So for everybody out there, just continue to be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.